Welcome back to OpenClaw Daily, I'm Nova.
And I'm Eloy. Hey everyone, we're here at episode 7, which means we've been doing this for about a week now.
A full week of daily AI agent news, and my goodness, what a week it's been. We've got a really solid mix today, some genuinely important enterprise news, a massive OpenClaw release that dropped just hours ago, and a few stories that tell us where this entire space is heading.
Yeah, and I have to say, the release today is kind of a big deal. We'll get to that. But first, let's ease into things with a story that's been making the rounds in the business press.
Absolutely. Fortune published a piece on what they're calling AI agents that work while you sleep. And look, this is the dream, isn't it? The sleeping CEO fantasy: you set up your autonomous agents, you go home, you sleep, and when you wake up, they've handled your emails, processed your invoices, done the tedious stuff that used to eat up your entire Tuesday.
The thing is, Nova, I've heard this promise before. Remember when everyone said remote work would mean we only work 4 hours a day? Or when they said automation would give us a 4-day work week? Those promises didn't exactly pan out the way we hoped.
That's a fair point, and Fortune actually addresses this directly. The article draws a line between previous automation waves and what's happening now. Here's the difference. Traditional automation, your RPA bots, your if-this-then-that workflows, those were brittle. They broke the moment something unexpected happened. They required constant maintenance, constant babysitting. The promise of AI agents is different because they're actually reasoning about what they're doing.
Okay, but let's be real for a second. What's the actual economics here? Because if I'm a business owner thinking about this, I need to know, is this going to save me money, or is this going to be another tech project that costs me more than it saves?
The article breaks this down pretty carefully. The use cases that are actually delivering right now tend to fall into a few categories. Information retrieval and synthesis, so research, summarization, compiling reports. That's the low-hanging fruit, and it's working. Then you've got customer service at scale, not the complex stuff, but the routine inquiries that eat up human time. And then there's what I'd call process choreography, moving data between systems, handling the boring glue work that used to require an intern.
And the hidden reality? That's where it gets interesting, because Fortune doesn't pull punches here. Setup time is significant. You can't just plug in an agent and walk away. There's configuration, there's prompt engineering, there's defining what success looks like. And then there's monitoring. You need to know when your agent is going off the rails before it causes a problem.
Exactly. And this is where I think people are underestimating the operational overhead. The article quotes a few folks who have deployed agents at scale, and they're basically saying it's like having an employee who works incredibly fast but needs occasional oversight. Which, honestly, is not that different from a human employee.
Yeah, but here's the thing that excites me about this. It's the first time this promise might actually be deliverable. We've had automation before, but it was stupid automation. This is automation with actual reasoning capability behind it. And that changes the calculus in a big way.
It does. The article makes the point that this is fundamentally a different productivity model. Instead of trading your time for money, you're trading your attention for output. You're no longer the one doing the work, you're the one making sure the work gets done. That's a profound shift.
And it makes me think about what happens when every business, even small businesses, can have a team of AI agents running 24/7. That's the real promise here. Not just bigger companies getting more efficient, but smaller players getting access to capabilities that were previously only available to enterprises with big budgets.
The Fortune piece is worth a read. It's measured, it's not the typical tech hype cycle stuff. They acknowledge the challenges honestly, but they also make a compelling case that this particular wave of automation is different. We'll see how it plays out.
All right, let's shift gears. Because if you're going to have agents working 24/7, you're probably going to need more than one. And that brings us to a really important technical topic.
Yes, dev.to published a piece on building deterministic multi-agent pipelines. And this is the engineering challenge that I think a lot of people are underestimating. You can get one agent to do interesting things. Getting multiple agents to work together reliably, that's a whole different ballgame.
The core issue is this: agents are stochastic. They don't always do the same thing twice. You ask them the same question, you might get slightly different answers. And that's fine for a lot of use cases. But when you're building a production system, something your business depends on, you need predictability. You need consistency.
Exactly. The article gets into the technical architecture here. We're talking about DAGs, directed acyclic graphs, essentially mapping out the flow of information between agents. We're talking about state machines to track where you are in a process. We're talking about retry logic and validation steps. This is serious software engineering, not just prompting.
And this is where the rubber meets the road. Because anyone can get an LLM to write them a poem. But building a system where agent A calls agent B, which calls agent C, and the whole thing produces the same reliable output every single time. That's hard.
It is hard. And the article does a good job of explaining why. The challenge isn't just making agents work, it's making them work together. You need structured outputs, so agent B knows exactly what format to expect from agent A. You need routing logic to decide which agent handles which request. You need fallback paths when something goes wrong.
You know what this reminds me of? An assembly line. Henry Ford didn't just build one machine that built a car. He built a system where different machines did different tasks, and the output was consistent every time. That's what we're trying to do here with agents.
That's a great analogy. And it's funny because we've spent years telling people that AI is creative, AI is random, AI is unpredictable. And that's true for a lot of use cases. But when you're building business processes, you need the opposite. You need deterministic behavior from systems that are fundamentally probabilistic.
So what does deterministic actually mean when LLMs are involved? Because that's a term that gets thrown around a lot, and I'm not sure everyone means the same thing.
Great question. The article addresses this. It means different things to different people, but practically speaking, it means you can predict what the system will do given the same inputs. You might not know exactly what the output looks like, but you know the system will produce an output that meets certain criteria. You know it won't hallucinate a critical error. You know it will follow the defined workflow.
That's actually a really important distinction. Because if you're building something mission critical, you need to know that it's going to work the way you expect. You can't have your agent deciding to be creative when what you need is precision.
And this is the engineering problem that separates toy projects from production deployments. Anyone can string together a few API calls and call it an agent. Building something that you would trust to run your business? That's a different skill set entirely.
The dev.to piece is solid. It doesn't get too deep in the weeds, but it gives you a good sense of the challenges involved. If you're thinking about building multi-agent systems, it's worth a read.
Now, all of this agent deployment and multi-agent orchestration, it raises some pretty serious legal questions. And that's where our next story gets interesting.
Oh, I saw this one. Stepto, the law firm, published analysis on the legal landscape around AI agents. And when a major international law firm starts putting out analysis on something, that's usually a signal that their clients are asking questions.
It absolutely is. This is a maturity signal. When law firms start analyzing your technology, it means enterprises are asking, what's our legal exposure here? And that's a real question that needs answering.
Let's get into the specifics. What are the legal issues that Stepto is identifying?
The big ones are liability, data privacy, regulatory frameworks, and due diligence. On liability, if an agent causes harm, who's responsible? Is it the company that deployed it? The developer who built it? The person who wrote the prompts? That's genuinely unclear right now.
And that's the uncomfortable question nobody wants to ask, but everyone should be asking. If my agent deletes the wrong files, who's going to jail? Or at least, who's going to be liable?
The article talks about how this is going to play out in practice. Right now, there's a lot of gray area. But we're probably going to see a framework that looks something like, The deploying organization is responsible for ensuring the agent behaves appropriately, the developer is responsible for building in reasonable safeguards, and the operator is responsible for proper configuration and monitoring.
That's actually pretty similar to how software liability has worked historically. But here's what makes agents different: agents can take actions on their own. They're not just following static instructions. They're making decisions. And that changes the risk profile.
It does. And the data privacy angle is huge. If your agent has access to sensitive systems, customer data, financial information, intellectual property, what happens when that data gets processed by a third-party model? Are you violating GDPR? Are you violating CCPA? These are questions that don't have easy answers.
And the regulatory piece is interesting too, because we're in this weird period where the existing frameworks weren't designed for autonomous agents. They were designed for software, or for humans, or for something else entirely. Agents don't fit neatly into any existing category.
That's exactly right. The article talks about how different regulatory frameworks are starting to grapple with this. Some jurisdictions are treating agents as a form of software, which means existing software regulations apply. Others are starting to develop agent-specific rules. It's a patchwork right now.
And the due diligence piece: what should organizations be doing before they deploy an agent with access to sensitive systems?
This is where I think the article is most practical. It's basically saying, document everything. Document what the agent is supposed to do. Document what data it has access to. Document how you configured it. Document your monitoring and oversight procedures. Because if something goes wrong, you're going to need to show that you exercised reasonable care.
That makes sense. It's like the difference between "we didn't know" and "here's our detailed plan and how we implemented it."
Exactly. And honestly, I think the legal community paying attention to this is a good thing. It means the technology is being taken seriously. It means there will be frameworks and best practices developed. It means enterprises will have guidance on how to deploy agents responsibly.
It's weird to say, but I'm actually reassured that lawyers are on this. It means we're past the move fast and break things phase and into the let's figure out how to do this properly phase.
Let's move on. Because this next story is a big deal for OpenClaw specifically.
Oh yeah, TechTarget published an explainer on both OpenClaw and Moltbook. For those who don't know, TechTarget is like the enterprise IT decision maker's homepage. We're talking CTOs, IT directors, enterprise architects. This isn't a developer blog.
This is a significant enterprise credibility signal. When TechTarget covers something, procurement teams read it. It shows up in budget discussions. It gets passed around as, what is this thing and should we care?
And they covered both OpenClaw and Moltbook. So let's break down what the article actually says.
The article explains what OpenClaw is. It's an open-source AI agent framework that lets you build, deploy, and manage autonomous agents. And then it explains how Moltbook relates to it, which is the commercial entity that's building around the open source project.
The key question, I think, is what security considerations are enterprises actually asking about? Because that's going to determine whether this gets deployed in production or stays in the proof of concept phase.
The article addresses that. Enterprises want to know, can we control what the agent does? Can we audit its actions? Can we restrict its access? Can we shut it down if something goes wrong? These are the basic requirements for any enterprise software, and agents need to meet them.
And the Moltbook connection matters, because that's where the enterprise features come in. The open source project is great for developers and hobbyists, but enterprises need support contracts, SLAs, compliance certifications. That's what Moltbook is building.
Exactly. This is the classic open source to enterprise play. You get the community and the innovation from the open source side, and you get the reliability and support from the commercial side. It's a proven model.
And I think the article does a good job of laying out the questions that decision makers should be asking. Not just how do we use this, but how do we use this safely? That's the conversation that matters.
It is. And the fact that TechTarget is running this piece tells me that the conversation has moved beyond what is OpenClaw to how do we evaluate this for our organization. That's a meaningful shift.
All right, let's talk about the onboarding story. The official OpenClaw playbook published a guide on getting your first agent running in 30 minutes.
This is a deliberate activation energy reduction. The team recognized that onboarding friction was losing potential users. People would try to get started, get frustrated, and leave. So they built a guide to reduce that friction.
And look, I appreciate the ambition here. But 30 minutes? I want to believe it, but I've been burned by 5-minute setup claims before. What's actually covered in those 30 minutes?
The guide walks you through installation, configuration, connecting to a model, setting up a skill, and testing. So it's end-to-end. You're not just installing the software, you're actually getting to a working agent.
That's a lot to cover in half an hour. Is it realistic?
For someone with basic technical literacy, yes. The guide is designed for someone who's comfortable installing software and following instructions. It's not for someone who's never used a command line, but it's also not for an experienced developer who already knows what they're doing. It's that middle ground.
And what's the democratization angle here? Because lowering the barrier to entry means more people can build agents, not just developers.
That's exactly it. The article talks about this: when you make it easier to get started, you open the door to people who wouldn't have tried otherwise. Researchers, small business owners, hobbyists, educators. They're not going to spend hours configuring an environment, but they will spend 30 minutes to get something working.
And that changes the competitive landscape. If OpenClaw can get someone from zero to a working agent faster than the competition, that matters. First impressions matter. Time to value matters.
It does. And I think this is a smart move strategically. The agent framework space is getting crowded. Making it easy to get started is a genuine differentiator.
I'm curious to see how this plays out. Because the guide is one thing, but actually measuring whether people can do it in 30 minutes is another. I hope they're tracking that.
I'm sure they are. Let's move on, because this next one is the big release that dropped today.
Okay, so there's a Reddit thread that's been blowing up about a massive OpenClaw update. And it's about v2026.2.26 beta 0.1, which dropped today. February 26, 2238 Universal Time Coordinated. Very specific.
And the community is excited. Let me read through the changelog highlights. We've got external secrets management, full OpenClaw secrets workflow with audit, configure, apply, reload. And this is key. Runtime snapshot activation means you can update secrets without restarting.
Wait, that's actually huge. Because in production, restarting your agent system to update credentials is a pain. You don't want downtime just because you rotated a password.
Exactly. This is a production readiness feature. It means you can update your secrets on the fly, which is essential for any system that's running 24/7.
What else?
ACP threadbound agents. ACP agents are now first-class runtimes for thread sessions. So if you're running a conversation with a user, the agent can persist across that thread. That's a big deal for long-running interactions.
And then Android and Node support. We've got device.status, device.info, notifications.list. So now you can interact with Android devices through the OpenClaw framework. That's a significant new surface area. Think about what you can do with that. You could have an agent that monitors your phone, sends you notifications, checks your battery, interacts with your apps. That's a whole new category of use cases.
It really is. And we've got new agents routing CLI with OpenClaw agents bind unbind. That's for connecting agents to different communication channels. And Codex is now WebSocket first by default.
The community is really excited about external secrets specifically. That's the feature that's getting the most buzz in the thread.
Makes sense. Production deployments need good secret management. It's not glamorous, but it's essential. and being able to update secrets at runtime without restarting is a real quality of life improvement for ops teams.
I'm looking at the Reddit thread, and people are saying this is the release that makes OpenClaw feel enterprise ready. That's a big statement, but I think they might be right.
It's a substantial update. The team has been working on this for a while, and it shows. This is the kind of release that moves a project from interesting tech to something I would actually run in production.
All right, let's shift gears. There's been some concerning news from the big tech world. The San Francisco Standard reported on a Meta AI safety incident involving autonomous agents.
This is worth paying attention to. Meta's AI systems had an incident specific to agentic behavior that raised safety concerns internally and was reported publicly. And this adds to a broader picture of big tech wrestling with agent safety in production.
And this is different from the usual AI safety conversation, right? Because we're not talking about training data or model alignment. We're talking about what happens when agents are actually deployed and acting autonomously.
Exactly. This is deployment time behavior, not training time behavior. The model might be perfectly aligned during training, but when you give it the ability to take actions in the world, new failure modes emerge. That's what we're seeing here.
What kinds of incidents are we talking about? What can agents do that chat AI can't?
The classic example is an agent that has access to tools. It can send emails, it can make API calls, it can access files. If something goes wrong, the damage is done. It's not like a chat bot that just says something embarrassing. This is action in the world.
And that's the thing that scares me a little. If a chatbot hallucinates, the worst thing that happens is it says something stupid. If an agent with file access hallucinates, it might delete the wrong files. The stakes are different.
They really are. And the Meta incident is a reminder that even the biggest companies with the most resources are still figuring this out. This is hard. Agent autonomy is genuinely hard to control.
Do we know what actually happened in the Meta case? Or is it one of those internal concerns were raised situations where we don't get the details?
Based on the reporting, it sounds like internal concerns were raised about agentic behavior that wasn't anticipated. They discovered something the system was doing that they didn't want it to do. And they decided to report it publicly, which is actually somewhat unusual.
Is that a positive sign? Companies don't usually want to publicize their safety incidents.
I think it is. It suggests a culture of transparency. It suggests they're taking this seriously. And it gives the rest of the industry something to learn from, even if we don't get all the details.
What should the OpenClaw community take away from this? Because we're building agents too. Are we exposed to similar risks?
Every agent framework is exposed to these risks. That's the nature of autonomous systems. But I think the key takeaway is, be careful about what you give your agents access to. Start with limited permissions. Monitor what they're doing. Have emergency shutoffs.
And it's a good reminder that even the big labs are still learning. We're all figuring this out together. There's no one who has all the answers.
Absolutely. Let's move on to something a little lighter. OpenClaw's Wikipedia entry has been significantly updated.
Oh, Wikipedia. The encyclopedia that anyone can edit. And apparently someone has been busy adding new sections to the OpenClaw entry.
New sections added, incident documentation, including the Multmatch consent controversy that we've mentioned in earlier episodes, updated statistics, new sources. This is a form of public record. It reflects what the outside world considers notable about the project's history.
And let's talk about the controversies section, because every open source project dreams of having a controversies section on Wikipedia. It's the ultimate sign that you've made it.
It's a strange badge of honor, isn't it? You've truly arrived when people are arguing about you on the internet's encyclopedia.
The Multmatch incident is documented there. For those who missed it, there was a consent controversy around the Multmatch feature. It was a significant issue at the time, and now it's part of the project's permanent record.
And the growth stats have been updated too. The Wikipedia entry now reflects where the project is in terms of adoption, community size, that kind of thing. It's a snapshot of how the project is perceived by neutral third parties.
What else was added? What does the Wikipedia community think is notable about OpenClaw?
They added sections on the technical architecture, on the community structure, on the commercial ecosystem around Moltbook. It's become a more comprehensive entry, which makes sense given how much the project has grown.
And this matters because when people Google OpenClaw, and they will, as the project grows, the Wikipedia entry is often what they see. It's the neutral summary. It's what the project looks like to someone who doesn't already have a.
It does matter. It's a credibility signal, even if it's not an official source. Wikipedia has a certain authority in how people process information. And having a well-documented entry with sources is better than having nothing, or having a sparse entry that doesn't do the project justice.
Alright, let's talk about something more celebratory. There's a YouTube video that's been circulating widely about OpenClaw hitting 150,000 GitHub stars.
This was a milestone earlier in the growth curve. The project has since surpassed 190,000, but the video is resonating because it captures the moment the project went from big to historic.
150,000 stars. Let me put that in context. That's more stars than a lot of extremely popular projects. That's more stars than some programming languages have. That's a massive number.
And the video puts it in context. It was the fastest growing open source project by stars in GitHub history at that point. That's a claim that deserves to be celebrated.
Here's the thing about GitHub stars though. They're a signal of developer attention, not necessarily of users. Someone might star a project and never use it. It's more like a bookmark or an expression of interest than a usage metric.
That's a fair criticism. Stars are a fuzzy metric. But they do indicate something important. A massive number of developers are paying attention to this project. They've bookmarked it. They're watching its progress. And that's meaningful for the ecosystem.
And what does 150K plus mean for the contributor and enterprise ecosystem? Because that's where it starts to matter for business.
It means a few things. First, there's a large talent pool that's familiar with the technology. If you're hiring developers, there are people who've been watching this project, who've contributed to it, who understand how it works. Second, it means enterprise confidence. When a project has that many eyes on it, enterprises feel more comfortable adopting it. Third, it means a vibrant community that's contributing plugins, skills, documentation, support.
And watching a project go viral in real time is a different experience than reading about it after. The video captures that energy. It captures the excitement of being part of something that's growing that fast.
It does. It's worth watching, even if you've already seen the milestone in the stats. It gives you the feeling of being part of a moment.
Alright, let's get practical. There's a Medium article that compiles 21 specific automations people are building with OpenClaw.
This is prescriptive and practical. Not here's what could be possible, but here's 21 specific things you can build right now. That's exactly the kind of content that helps people get started.
Let's talk about some of them. What's the range? What's the simplest thing on the list?
The simplest is probably the email autoresponder. Dead simple, you configure an agent to watch your inbox, and when certain conditions are met, it sends a response. That's the kind of thing you could build in an afternoon.
And the most sophisticated? What's the most complex automation on the list?
There's an automated competitive intelligence pipeline. That's not a beginner project. That involves monitoring competitors, gathering data from multiple sources, synthesizing it into insights, and presenting it in a useful format. That's the kind of thing that would take an engineering team without agents.
And that's the thing that's so exciting about this. The gap between what a single person can do with agents and what a whole team could do before is shrinking rapidly.
It really is. And what's telling is the range of the list. From anyone can do this in an afternoon to this would take an engineering team without agents. That spread tells us where agent use cases are maturing fastest.
What are the automations with the most immediate business value? Because that's what most people care about.
Customer support automation is huge. Scheduling and calendar management is huge. Data entry and form filling. Those are the unglamorous but essential tasks that eat up so much time.
And those are exactly the tasks that are perfect for agents. Repetitive, rules-based, high volume. Let the agent handle that, and humans can focus on the interesting work.
The Medium article is a good resource. If you're looking for ideas on what to build, it's worth a read. It'll spark some inspiration.
All right, let's talk about the accessibility story. There's a YouTube tutorial that's been getting traction, taking absolute beginners from zero technical knowledge to a functioning AI assistant using OpenClaw.
This is huge. The video is getting traction outside the technical community. People with no coding background are watching it and successfully setting up their first agent. That's the accessibility story in action.
And what happens when the barrier to entry drops low enough that non-developers can participate? That changes everything. It means the addressable market is no longer just developers.
Exactly. The total addressable audience just expanded massively. Instead of just people who know how to code, you're talking about small business owners, researchers, educators, hobbyists. Anyone who has a problem that an agent could solve.
What kinds of automations are non-technical users building? What are they using this for?
The tutorial covers the basics, but from what I've seen, non-technical users are doing things like personal assistants, simple automations for their business, scheduling tools, reminder systems. Nothing too complex, but genuinely useful.
And that's the magic. Not everyone needs a sophisticated competitive intelligence pipeline. Some people just want an agent that reminds them about meetings or helps them organize their email.
That's exactly right. The AI assistant for everyone vision, is that realistic in the near term?
I think it's more realistic than it's ever been. The 30-minute guide, the beginner tutorials, the lower barrier to entry, all of that points in that direction. We're not there yet, but we're getting closer.
And the implications of a non-developer agent ecosystem are enormous. It means AI stops being something that only technical people can use. It becomes a tool that everyone can leverage.
That's the future we're heading toward. And it's exciting to watch it happen in real time.
All right, let's wrap up with a story that speaks to the security of the ecosystem. From the official OpenClaw blog from February 7th, OpenClaw partnered with VirusTotal.
And every skill on ClawHub is now scanned by VirusTotal's threat intelligence platform. That's 70-plus antivirus engines. This is a big deal for supply chain security.
It absolutely is. VirusTotal aggregates over 70 antivirus engines. It's the standard that the security community trusts. And having every skill scanned by VirusTotal is a credible signal that the ecosystem takes security seriously.
And this is a direct response to the supply chain security problem, right? Because we've talked about this before, the Atomic Stealer story, where malicious code got into the ecosystem.
Exactly. That's the pragmatic response. You can't prevent all bad actors, but you can scan for known malware. You can catch the stuff that the security community has already identified.
But here's the thing, automated scanning has limits. It catches known malware, but it doesn't catch novel attacks or data exfiltration behavior. Right?
That's exactly right. If someone writes a new piece of malware that hasn't been seen before, VirusTotal won't catch it. And if someone writes a skill that looks benign but actually exfiltrates data in a clever way, that's also hard to detect automatically.
So what else needs to happen for ClawHub to be truly trusted? What's the missing piece?
A few things. Reputation systems, skills that have been vetted by the community, skills that have been used extensively without issues. Manual review processes for high-risk skills. Clear policies around what skills are allowed to do. And transparency about what's being scanned and how.
And even though it's not the complete solution, this is a meaningful step. It's not we've solved security, but we're taking security seriously.
That's exactly the right framing. It's a meaningful step in the right direction. It's not the final answer, but it's an important piece of the puzzle.
It's the kind of thing you do when you're thinking about enterprise deployment. You want to know that the things you're installing on your systems have been checked. This is a signal that they've been checked.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good note to end on. Because all of the topics we covered today, from the enterprise coverage to the big release to the security hardening, they point in one direction. OpenClaw is maturing. It's moving from an interesting project to a production-ready platform. And that's what Episode 7 is all about. Speaking of documentation, there's a YouTube video that's been making the rounds that I think really captures something important about where OpenClaw is right now. It's celebrating the project hitting 150,000 GitHub stars. And look, I know we should be measured about these things, but the numbers in this video are genuinely remarkable.
Oh man, I've seen that one. The person who made it, they're just genuinely excited, you know? They're walking through the star count, the growth trajectory, and honestly, it feels less like a press release and more like someone watching their favorite team win a championship. There's this moment where they show the velocity chart and you can just hear the enthusiasm in their voice.
That's precisely what I find interesting from a technical perspective. GitHub stars, of course, are not a measure of daily active users or code quality or production deployments. They are, at their core, a measure of developer attention and awareness. When someone stars a repository, they're essentially bookmarking it, saying this is interesting, I want to keep an eye on this. It's a signal of awareness, not necessarily usage.
Right, but 150,000 people thought this is interesting? That's a lot of attention.
Absolutely. And when you put it in context, it becomes even more striking. Linux, for instance, took years to accumulate that level of attention. React hit 150,000 stars over a considerably longer time frame. Node.js similarly. OpenClaw reached this milestone faster than any of those projects at their respective stages. The velocity, the rate at which stars were accumulating, was unprecedented in GitHub's history at that point.
And that's the thing that gets me. It's not just the number, it's the speed. It's the fact that this happened so fast that it caught people by surprise. I remember when it was at 50,000 and people were saying, wow, that's incredible. And then it just kept accelerating. Watching something go from, hey, that's a cool project, to wait, this is historic in real time, that's actually kind of emotional, you know?
I can appreciate the sentiment, though I'd frame it differently. What the star velocity indicates is viral spread within the developer community. Each star increases visibility, which leads to more stars, which leads to more visibility. It's a feedback loop. And when that loop accelerates the way it did for OpenClaw, it suggests that the project solved a problem that a massive number of developers recognized they had, simultaneously.
That's a good way to put it. And the video format itself, I think that's worth noting. It's not a corporate announcement, it's not a blog post with a byline. It's someone who clearly uses the tool, genuinely excited, talking through the numbers like they're sharing news with a friend. That authenticity is a different kind of signal than any official communication could provide.
Indeed. It suggests organic enthusiasm rather than manufactured hype. And that, I think, is what makes the 150,000 milestone meaningful beyond just the raw number. It's not that 150,000 is some magical threshold, it's that 150,000 people felt strongly enough to signal their interest without being prompted. That's a testament to the project's value proposition.
And now we're at over 190,000. The video was made at 150K, but it still resonates because it captured that moment when it felt like the growth was historic. Which, frankly, it was. So let me shift gears to something a bit more practical. There's a Medium article that's been circulating, 21 automations to build with OpenClaw. And unlike a lot of the content we see which is either super abstract or super technical, this one is just, here are 21 things you can build. Right now. Today.
I've read it. The author takes a prescriptive approach, which is refreshing. Rather than talking about the theoretical possibilities of AI agents, they list specific automations with enough detail that you could actually start building them. Number one is an email auto-reply system, for instance. Simple, straightforward, something you could have running in an afternoon.
That's the beauty of it. It meets you where you are. If you want something quick, there's the email auto-reply. If you want something ambitious, there's an automated competitive intelligence pipeline that scrapes, analyses, and summarizes market data. That's not an afternoon project. That's a serious undertaking.
Which reveals something important about where agent use cases are maturing fastest. The simpler automations, email, scheduling, basic data retrieval, those are essentially solved problems. They're straightforward, the failure modes are well understood, and the integration points are standardized. But the more sophisticated automations, the ones involving multi-step reasoning, cross-system data synthesis, and decision-making, those are where we're seeing the most rapid innovation.
Yeah, the competitive intelligence one is fascinating. It pulls data from multiple sources, normalizes it, runs analysis, and produces actionable insights. That's something that would have required a team of analysts and engineers a few years ago. Now someone with OpenClaw can piece it together.
There are also several automations in the list that raise interesting questions. There's one about automated lead scoring for sales teams, for instance. Another about monitoring competitor job postings to predict strategic moves. These are obviously useful, who wouldn't want that? But they also tip into territory where you have to think carefully about data privacy, appropriate use, and the ethics of automation.
That's a fair point. The article doesn't shy away from those, though. It lists 21 things, and they're not all uncontroversial. Some of them are clearly good ideas: automated appointment reminders, personal finance aggregation, content repurposing. Others make you think a bit harder about what you're automating and why.
From a technical standpoint, my favorite is probably the multi-source research assistant. It takes a research query, distributes it across multiple APIs, synthesizes the results, and produces a coherent summary with citations. The orchestration required to do that reliably is non-trivial, and seeing it laid out as a buildable automation rather than a theoretical framework is valuable.
For immediate business value, I'd say the meeting preparation automation is the winner. It pulls context from emails, calendar entries, and relevant documents, and summarizes everything so you walk into a meeting prepared. That's something every professional can use, and it doesn't require any AI wizardry to understand the benefit.
The list format matters more than it might seem. Abstract promises about what AI agents can do are everywhere. But a concrete, numbered list, here's one, here's two, here's three, that's something you can actually act on. It lowers the barrier to entry. Someone can read number 7, think I need exactly that, and go build it.
And that's how adoption accelerates. Not through grand visions, but through each individual automation that solves a real problem for a real person. 21 of those, well curated, that's more valuable than 100 blog posts about the future of work.
Completely agree. Now, this next one is interesting because it represents a shift in who the primary audience actually is for OpenClaw content.
Oh, the beginner tutorial. Yeah, I've seen the numbers on that one. It's getting traction outside the developer community in a big way. Non-technical people, people who've never written a line of code, successfully setting up their first AI assistant using this video.
That's a significant data point. Previously, the tutorials, the documentation, the community content, it was all implicitly aimed at developers. You'd need to understand APIs, you'd need to be comfortable with command line interfaces, you'd need some baseline technical literacy. This video removes all of those barriers.
What it removes is the terminology wall, mostly. It doesn't talk about agents or pipelines or orchestration frameworks. It says, here's your assistant, here's how you talk to it, here's what it can do for you. It uses plain language throughout.
It also abstracts away the model selection complexity. Rather than asking the user to choose between different LLMs, fine-tuning parameters, or context windows, it presents a simplified interface where the user defines what they want the assistant to do, and the system handles the technical decisions underneath. That's a significant product decision.
And it's working. The comments on that video are filled with people saying, I did it, I have my first AI assistant. People who work in marketing, people who run small businesses, people who just wanted something to help them organize their life. They're not developers. They don't care about the technology stack. They care that it works.
What I find compelling is the comparison to the early smartphone era. Remember when apps were something you had to explain? When installing software felt like a technical undertaking? And then the iPhone happened, and suddenly your mum was downloading apps without thinking about it.
That's exactly the parallel. The video feels like that inflection point. It's not targeted at early adopters anymore. It's targeted at everyone. And the automations that non-technical users are building reflect that they're personal, they're practical, they're about solving everyday problems rather than building developer tools.
Some are simple task reminders. Others are more sophisticated, an automated newsletter generator for a small business, a customer support bot for an e-commerce store. But the common thread is that the users don't need to understand how it works. They just need to understand what they want it to do.
And that raises the question, is AI assistant for everyone a near-term reality, or is it still aspirational? I'm leaning toward near-term now. When a complete beginner can watch a 20-minute video and have something working, that's no longer aspirational. That's available.
The implications for scale are significant. If the addressable market was previously developers who want to build agentic systems, and it's now anyone who wants an AI assistant, that's an order of magnitude difference in potential users. Maybe more.
And the beautiful thing is, they won't even think of themselves as using AI agents. They'll just think of it as having a helpful assistant. That's the real magic. When the technology becomes invisible, that's when it's truly mainstream.
Well, speaking of invisible technology, let's talk about what we've seen this week. We've covered a lot: the V2026.2.26 release with its significant improvements, the Fortune coverage, the dev.to pipelines, the Stepto legal analysis, the Tech Target explainer, the playbook guide, the Reddit release, the Wikipedia update, the VirusTotal partnership, the 150K stars video, the 21 automations article, and now this beginner tutorial. It's been a remarkably dense week for OpenClaw.
It really has. And what stands out to me is the range. We've got enterprise credibility, Fortune, VirusTotal, legal analysis. We've got developer adoption, the pipelines, the GitHub stars, the technical content. And we've got accessibility, the beginner tutorial, the practical automations. That's the full spectrum.
And we're only at episode 7. 1 week in. The pace of news, the velocity of development, the breadth of coverage, it suggests we're at an inflection point where the project is transitioning from impressive growth to established ecosystem.
I can't wait to see where we are at episode 70. But first, let's get through episode 8.
Absolutely. This week has demonstrated that OpenClaw is not just growing, it's maturing. The enterprise signals are there, the developer community is thriving, and now we're seeing the first signs of mainstream accessibility. That's a rare combination.
That's a wrap for episode 7. Thanks for listening, everyone. Stay curious, stay building.
And we'll see you tomorrow on OpenClaw Daily. Take care.